In our first story, Behind Mansion Walls, a bloody corpse.
Imagine going on with your day knowing there's a dead body down in the pool house.
Reveals a doctor's darkest secret.
She was just 15.
And later, sex, power, and politics.
She had been around political power all her life, and she played hard.
It's a deadly mix.
She became the person responsible for his fall from grace.
I'm Christopher Mason. Most modern brides no longer vow to obey their husbands. But behind mansion walls, some rich and powerful men still believe their wealth can command total obedience. And when a woman refuses to bow to her lord and master, the results can be lethal.
Night falls on an exclusive California estate. In the dark, a shadowy figure is frantically searching. 15-year-old Gabriel Polk.
Dad.
Is looking for his father, Felix.
Dad, where are you?
They planned to go to a ball game together hours ago, but Dad has disappeared.
Dad?
He went looking for him on the property. He decided to check the pool house. And that's where he made a grisly discovery.
There was blood everywhere.
Dad.
I could see a little bit on the walls.
Help.
The floor was splattered everywhere. This one it registers as one of the worst cases that I've had to deal with.
Nestled in a valley just 20 minutes from San Francisco lies the picturesque hamlet of Orinda. Named by Forbes as the second friendliest place in the United States, it's certainly one of the most upscale.
That's the type of area where your homes will typically run in the millions. Most of the residents there can be executives. It's just considered a very high society type area, and very quiet, but very influential.
Successful psychologist Felix Polk has joined Orinda's elite.
Felix was well known in the psychotherapy community. He was very well respected. He did a lot of research in the field, and he had lots of patients who looked up to him and leaned on him for help.
All right, who was it?
Go!
Now nearly 70, Felix has forked out nearly $2 million for a sedate slice of rural splendor.
Come on! Kelly.
They lived in a nice house in Orinda. It was three stories. It had a pool and a separate pool house.
Daddy.
Lush trees all over the property. It was a very beautiful place to raise a family.
That family includes three sons and his wife of almost 20 years, Susan, the perfect partner.
So fast.
Attractive, smart, dutiful, and younger. Much younger.
Boys, come on in.
So he's 25 years older than she is. And so this was a very, some would say, very odd relationship. But the two clicked.
October 14th, 2002. While Susan does her usual round of household chores, son Gabriel waits impatiently for his father to come home from work.
You know where he is?
They have a date at the ballpark. But as the afternoon wears on, Felix doesn't return. When he misses dinner, Gabriel is worried.
Gabe called his father's office. There was no answer.
He's not answering his cell phone either.
Have you heard from Dad?
Felix is now 6 hours late. Gabriel knows something's wrong.
Gabe gets worried and he's looking for his dad.
He hasn't heard from him at all.
So he starts looking all over the property. and he goes into the pool house. And there in the pool house, he discovers his father in a massive amount of blood.
Shocked and horrified, Gabriel calls 911 and makes a chilling claim.
My mom shot my dad.
Sergeant Ken Hansen is first on the scene. The years have not dimmed his memory of the horrific sight inside the pool house that night.
Mr. Polk was lying on his back. He was in some shorts. And he was covered in blood, and the scene had copious amounts of blood spread about. It looked like there had been a terrific struggle. It was not a fresh corpse. Mr. Polk had been dead, for my opinion, at the initial sight, for several hours.
The police soon discover Gabriel was mistaken. His father wasn't shot. He was stabbed.
There were numerous wounds all over his body, evidence that he had tried to fight back, fight his attacker away. But there were no signs of any gunshot wounds and no signs of the murder weapon. He'd also suffered blunt force trauma to his head.
Wounds on Felix's feet tell of a desperate fight for survival.
Knife wounds in his feet indicated that when he was first stabbed, or during at one point that he was stabbed, he fell back and the aggressor was still coming at him, and he was trying to kick away the aggressor, and that creates the knife wounds in the feet. So it was considered a very violent death.
Police can't locate a murder weapon, but they do find bloody footprints. A small shoe size, perhaps a woman's or a young man's. Both mother and son are detained for questioning. And detectives wonder, why would Gabriel lie about how his father died?
Is this really necessary?
Was Susan the murderer? Was Gabe the murderer? Was one of them trying to pin the blame on the other?
The mystery deepens when forensics can't find a match for the shoe prints. Then, the victim's car is found at a nearby train station, possibly abandoned by a fleeing killer. Who would want a 70-year-old psychologist dead? A crazed patient, perhaps. But Felix's wife has another theory. In the police interrogation room, a subdued Susan Polk wonders what happened to her husband.
But we have to do this.
What did happen?
Well, that's what I'm hoping you can tell me what happened.
I did not hear any gunshots. I don't own a firearm. So what had happened to my husband? Is he dead?
As far as I can tell, yeah. There's a person in that house, in that guest house, that's no longer...
Did my son see him?
I don't know.
I was pretty much there for most of the day. I didn't hear anything.
Mm-hmm.
The question for Susan Polk is, who has the motive? Who would want her husband dead?
So it wasn't like there's any loan sharks out to get him or anything like that, that you know of.
Goodness, no. Okay.
Well, I'm trying to think of everything, what could have happened here.
Well, that's your job. It's not my job.
No.
So I don't know.
All you can do is try to answer my questions as honestly and truthfully as you can.
Well, I am trying to do that, but I didn't kill him.
Mm-hmm. Who did?
I don't know.
No. Did Gabriel kill him?
Gabriel wouldn't kill his father.
You think so?
No, that's his father.
Susan rules out her son as a suspect, then points the finger overseas to the Israeli Secret Service, Mossad.
He has a friend who I think probably is a Mossad agent because of statements that his friend has made that sort of imply that he is.
She made her husband looked like he'd come out of some CIA novel and had ties to the spy world and was a violent, vicious guy.
The good citizens of Orinda, California are reeling after wealthy psychologist Felix Polk is found dead in his pool house. They're not accustomed to such savagery in America's second friendliest city. And anxious fingers are once again clutching at pearl necklaces when Susan Paul claims her husband was murdered by foreign spies.
Susan had a lot of intriguing things to say about Felix. She told him that Felix was an agent for the Mossad, the Israeli spy agency, and they had millions of dollars stashed away someplace. And that was a motive for murder.
In her police interview, Susan lifts the veil on her husband's secret world.
My husband had trained, and you know, in his practice, he sees CIA agents, he sees ATF agents, he sees Internal Revenue Service agents, he sees judges, he sees district attorneys. I mean, he knows everybody. I know, for instance, that he turned information over to an Israeli agent that he got from one of his patients, because he had a meeting at the house and he did that and he told me that he'd done it.
Was that activity enough to trigger a hit on Felix Polk? It's an extraordinary tale of international intrigue. But could it possibly be true? Investigators can find nothing to link the psychologist to Israeli spooks. Besides, his murder doesn't look like a cold-blooded professional hit.
This is typical of a domestic violence situation. Usually when a stabbing occurs from one person to another, if it's a stranger, it's maybe one or two. If it's 22 stab wounds, it indicates a severe and intense anger.
Detectives believe the killer is someone much closer to home. And their suspicions deepen when son Gabriel reveals large cracks in the Polk family portrait.
You think that it's my fault all the time.
Gabe starts talking about the acrimony that was going on between his parents.
Every time the boys get together here, we're having a good time.
They were in the midst of a nasty divorce.
I don't know what you're doing here anyway.
And Susan Polk was on the verge of losing everything.
Police learned that not only had she lost custody of the house, she lost custody of Gabe, and her child support payments were cut.
Oh my God.
With their marriage unraveling, the couple's feuding escalates. In a sprawling mansion like this, it's easy to find some personal space. So Felix moves into the pool house. Had Susan finally decided to end this marriage without a divorce? A clue comes from the corpse itself. The dead psychologist could hold the key to this case in the palm of his hand.
As they started to do the forensic analysis of the body, they see him clutching, kind of his hand in a clutching motion because of the way he was laying. They looked and he had hair in his hands as if he'd been in an altercation and grabbed someone's hair. The hair was consistent with Susan Polk's hair.
But even before the forensic evidence comes back, detectives are beginning to feel very confident they have Felix Polk's killer sitting right in front of them.
You need to tell the truth what happened. You really
I've
do.
Told
it's the
truth.
Only thing that's really going to help you at this
that
point.
That is the truth.
I got to tell you, something happened between you and Felix today. It got out of hand.
No way.
Well, that's my feeling.
It did not.
Okay?
Well, yeah.
All the evidence suggested, everything points to it.
It didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
I did not kill my husband.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
After 2 days of intense questioning, Susan Polk finally confesses to the killing. But she says she acted in self-defense.
So on the night in question, Susan claims that she went to the pool house.
Now what do you want?
To discuss the divorce with Felix.
Oh my God, he's trying to get it.
And all of a sudden, Felix pepper sprayed her. Felix attacked her with a knife.
She said he was going to kill her. And he had control over her. she was able to stab him with a knife just to get him off of her.
She grabbed the knife in self-defense and killed him to protect herself.
The way Susan tells it, she's freed herself from the clutches of a controlling, abusive monster.
Susan would accuse Felix of all kinds of abuse, physical, mental, psychological, and she would say that he had the ability to rid her of her mental demons, but instead, according to Susan, Felix used his power as a psychotherapist to gain and maintain control over Susan.
She started coming up with wild accusations. He would hypnotize her. He would alienate her from her family. She said he used a lot of mind control techniques on her to get her to do what he wanted to do.
So what's the truth about Felix? Was the psychotherapist just plain psycho? Susan's extraordinary accusations are just the beginning. She's about to reveal the most depraved secret of all.
He had an inappropriate relationship.
Nothing wrong with being pretty.
She was just 15.
Shouldn't feel bad about that.
What's been happening at school?
It's 1972. In Berkeley, California.
You can see what you like.
40-year-old Felix Polk is a high-flying psychotherapist, specializing in adolescent psychology.
Well, Felix was so well known and respected that many school districts refer patients and so-called problem children to him.
No one understands me.
Dr. Polk's latest subject is a troubled 15-year-old.
She was kind of an interesting kid. She really loved to read. She was kind of a loner.
So.
Had some problems in school because she was such a loner, but extremely bright.
How do you feel about that?
I feel angry.
She was quite intelligent, but she was socially fragile.
Why do you think that is?
She had problems getting to know people, getting to interact with others. That was how she was referred to Dr. Polk by her school.
But behind closed doors, it seems the good doctor might be interested in more than just therapy.
And they developed a relationship, an inappropriate relationship, and that would be the nicest thing to say about it. She says that they had intimate relations before she was 18.
It's natural. Nothing wrong with being pretty.
So Felix had violated the most sacrosanct of the doctor-patient relationship. You're not supposed to have any intimate relationships with your patients, let alone teenage patients. And at that point, Dr. Polk was a married father of three, 40 years old, and she was just 15.
Nothing to beat yourself up about.
That 15-year-old girl went on to become his wife. Susan Polk claims Felix raped her during those first visits. And those sordid sessions were just the start of decades of abuse.
Susan started to paint a picture of her being the victim, that he was the one who had controlled her, manipulated her, brainwashed her, that he was the source of all her problems.
Despite Susan's allegations, District Attorney Paul Sequeira has nagging doubts about her self-defense story.
When you look at the pictures of her, you see that there's no wounds. She had one little mark, tiny, tiny little mark. But for the struggle that she had described, she should have had lots of bruising. No cuts from the knife on her hands from when she tried to grab it to defend herself. She had no bruising anywhere.
And if it was self-defense, why didn't she call police immediately? Instead, a day after Felix's death, Susan still acts as though she doesn't have a care in the world.
The next day, she acted like nothing happened. And what's remarkable about it is, if you can imagine being in your home and going on with your day knowing there's a dead body down in the pool house that's been butchered, laying there in a pool of blood. Then she goes on and she washes the knife, puts it back in the drawer. She does the laundry, takes the kids to school, makes the lunch, just goes on with her day as if nothing happened.
Even in the police interrogation, Susan Polk is strangely unemotional.
I did not kill my husband.
Did you put somebody up to it?
Of course not.
No? And I got to tell you, the other thing, you're sitting here, you know, we've been together for an hour now or so, and you don't seem really choked up. You don't seem really upset that he's gone. I find that kind of, I mean, granted.
Very, very, very upset.
Mm-hmm. You do well not showing it.
Perhaps most puzzling, why let her son find his father's body?
I think for her to have her son find his dad in that kind of condition is horrific.
Dad?
It's so unmotherlike that I can't grasp the concept.
Help!
For Ken Hansen, one moment from that night sticks in his memory.
I informed Mrs. Polk that I had located her husband and appeared that he was dead and from unnatural causes. And Mrs. Polk responded to me.
Oh, well, we were going to get divorced anyway.
No emotions. It was like I was telling her the time of day. It chilled me. It made my like she had ice running through her veins.
And in the days before his death, Felix was already watching his back.
The police had been out there a number of times to solve domestic disputes. Felix had made a call and said that she'd threatened to kill him. Gabe backed that up and said, yes, I've heard her make threats over the phone that she wanted to kill him. And so that started to lead the police in a particular direction.
Unlike her blood-stained clothes, Susan's story just won't wash. She's charged with murder.
My version is she went down to talk to him. He let her in because he tried to maintain an amicable relationship with her.
Is that you, Susan?
It's me. Who do you think it is?
I think that she pepper sprayed him. And then she hit him on the head with something hard and stunned him and disabled him to some degree. He was a 70-year-old man who wasn't in the best of health. And she was able to gain control of him and stab him multiple times and kill him. I think Felix was scared to death. I mean, we have police reports before where he told the police, we also have statements to his kids that if anything ever happens to me, your mother did this to me.
Perhaps it was Felix's warning that came back to son Gabriel that fateful night.
My mom shot my dad.
The first thing he says is, the first thing he thinks about is, my mother shot my father. That's the first person in his mind that he believes would have killed his father.
But what drove Susan Polk to murder? The prosecution ties it all back to money and family. Susan was terrified of losing access to her sons, her house, and Dr. Polk's fortune. During her first police interview, the clues to Susan's motives leak out. Felix had gained custody of their son, Gabriel, and had turned her money tap off.
I get this phone call that, guess what? You know, you just lost custody of your son. Your husband has exclusive use of the house, and you get $1,700 a month to live in. I'm like, you've got to be kidding, because I don't have a job, you know? And I mean, my insurance for my car and my car payment alone take up like $800. Yeah, so what was I going to live on?
I got to tell you, Susan, it's, you know, right now we have to look at you as possibly doing this, having done this. You have the motive, you know, the marital problems going on. I'm sure tempers are not good between you, you know, as in any divorce.
He is my sole source of income.
Mm-hmm.
There is no life insurance.
Mm-hmm.
I would not kill my husband. I can't pay the bill.
Well, right now I have to focus on you.
During an extraordinary 5.5-month trial, her sons Gabriel and Adam testify against her.
And these two sons told the jury that she was the abuser, that she was the one who would be upset and belligerent and irrational and unreasonable. And they spoke of threats of violence. They said Susan wanted to hold Felix hostage until he transferred millions of dollars from his account. She had threatened to kill him with a shotgun. She had dreamt of all these ways to kill Felix, her tormentor, the person she believed was responsible and the root of all her problems.
After firing four lawyers, Susan conducts her own defense, often clashing with prosecutor Paul Sekira.
At one point, she gave me a hard time because I said, when you wash that knife, did you put that knife in the dishwasher, the murder weapon? And she looked at me and she goes, obviously, you've never had fine cutlery. You don't put cutlery like that in the dishwasher. You wash it by hand. You wouldn't know that.
Susan Polk is found guilty of second-degree murder and receives the maximum sentence, 16 years to life.
Susan really believed that Felix was her tormentor, that he was the root cause of all her problems. So I believe the motive was for her to get rid of this problem once and for all. Felix may have had his faults, especially because he chose to have a relationship with his patient, but no one deserves to be murdered brutally.
When money talks, it often expects to be listened to and obeyed. I've seen it many times. Rich men convince their wealth entitles them to total obedience. And it's even more lethal when you combine financial clout with political power. In that case, you either toe the line or wear a toe tag.
They say the early bird gets the worm.
She showed up at work early every single day.
But this ambitious young woman is not the only early riser. Someone is waiting for her.
Her last words were, "No, no, please don't, oh my God."
In a few seconds.
Bang, bang, bang. As quickly as he could pull the trigger.
A life full of promise is blown away.
The whole scene was just splattered with blood.
When people in Kentucky talk about good breeding, they're not always talking about racehorses. 29-year-old Amanda Ross and her fiancé, 56-year-old Stephen Nunn, are pure thoroughbreds, a glamorous couple, rubbing well-tailored shoulders with the pillars of Kentucky society.
They would go to balls. You'd see them at political events. I believe they went to at least one Kentucky Derby.
Amanda and Stephen are products of two of the bluegrass state's bluest bloodlines.
Amanda Ross was the daughter of a very successful, very influential man, and very wealthy.
Her late father, Terrell Ross, was a powerful local financier who wielded political clout. His feisty Democrat daughter believes she too has what it takes to be a success in politics.
Amanda Ross showed such work ethic and potential. She potentially could have been a political powerhouse in her own right.
She had been around political power all her life, and she played hard, but she worked. She didn't play on the idea that she came from wealth. She worked hard.
As for her fiancé, well, When it comes to Kentucky politics, names don't come much bigger than his. When Stephen was a teenager, he called this lavish building home. The governor's mansion in Lexington, where for 4 years his famous father ran the state of Kentucky.
You can't really talk about Steve Nunn without talking about his father, Louis B. Nunn. Louis B. Nunn was kind of a larger-than-life figure. He was the only Republican elected as Kentucky's governor from 1947 to 2003.
His father was a great big man, tall, kind of had a commanding presence.
Though he died in 2004, Louis still casts a long shadow over Kentucky politics. Son Stephen has worked hard to make his own name as a legislator and an outspoken crusader against domestic violence.
Absolutely.
Steve actually had sponsored a state law that made it a death penalty offense to kill somebody who has a domestic violence order out against you.
Amanda Ross finds that kind of political conviction very attractive. Despite the age gap and the fact that they come from opposite sides of politics, the couple has the world at their feet. But in the time it takes to squeeze a trigger, that will all change.
There was a streak, and she says, "Don't do it."
In the fiery partisan atmosphere of Washington, D.C., some Republicans and Democrats barely give each other the time of day. But while they may clash over tax breaks or immigration, politicians of every stripe are fluent in one common language, the mother tongue of power and influence.
In Kentucky, Republican Senator Stephen Nunn and dyed-in-the-wool Democrat Amanda Ross are doing more than reaching across the aisle. They are proof that politics makes for strange bedfellows.
The two were very similar. They both liked to drink and socialize. The folks who interacted with Steve Nunn and Amanda Ross as a couple seemed to think that they were a good fit for each other.
Such a good fit, in fact, Amanda is adding to Stephen's bulging collection of private pornography.
He was collecting photos of women with whom he'd been in relationships with.
Cute Southern Belle.
The nude photos that Steve Nunn collected included photos of Amanda Ross.
Beautiful. Grab the pillow, something cute.
But she's more than just another page of flesh in Steve's scrapbook. She could turn out to be his savior. Before meeting Amanda, Stephen's career had stalled. In 2003, he failed to emulate his father and lost the Republican nomination for governor. Then, in 2006, he lost his seat in the state legislature. Louis Nunn's legacy was starting to weigh heavily.
There was that pressure of living up to his father's expectations and quite possibly a sense of failure.
I think Steve Nunn certainly felt that his father didn't approve of the job that he had done.
With his career in freefall, Stephen's private life also begins to spiral.
Drinking very heavily, abusing substances, and generally suffering from depression.
But after meeting Amanda in 2007, his fortunes have turned around. A plum government position in the Department of Health and a wedding on the horizon. It seems the dark days are over. September 11th, 2009. It's 6:30 a.m. Just as she does most days, Amanda Ross leaves early for work.
It was a Friday morning. People were starting to get up and get ready for work. No one was really outside.
She walks straight into an ambush.
Amanda was walking to her car. When she was about halfway there, an unknown subject came out of the shadows.
She was dead right there in the parking lot.
The killer vanishes as quickly as he appeared. There are no eyewitnesses. A young woman, gunned down in cold blood. To Detective Rob Wilson, it just doesn't make sense.
You look for an obvious motive. There's a sexual assault or a robbery. There's obviously no sign of any sexual assault. Miss Ross's purse and valuables were still at the scene, so we didn't believe this was going to be a case of a robbery, which led us to believe that this was more of a personal crime or a personal vendetta against Miss Ross.
Amanda had filed a harassment case against a work colleague. Was that a motive for murder? Or maybe it's payback for her fiancé's tough stance on domestic violence. The murder investigation takes a sudden turn when detectives discover Amanda Ross had taken out her own restraining order.
There was a domestic violence order issued against Steve Nunn.
Really good night.
It seems that behind closed doors, the perfect couple was anything but.
The relationship had deteriorated.
I'd like to go out for some chicken wings.
Let me take you out. What's wrong with staying here?
Mr. Nunn's relationship with Miss Ross seemed pretty volatile. One of those love-hate relationships, as much as we can determine. They had a lot of fun together, from what we've been told, and they also had some pretty harsh falling outs.
Stephen and Amanda were drinking heavily. Their alcohol-fueled arguments escalated to the point where a simple disagreement over dinner turned violent.
Steve and Amanda had gotten into a argument, and he was trying to leave the house, and she would not permit him to leave.
I didn't mean it.
And that's what led to the confrontation.
Stephen is charged with domestic violence. For a noted campaigner against domestic violence, the fallout is catastrophic. Not only does he lose his girl, Stephen Nunn's newly resurrected career crumbles overnight.
That was the beginning of the end for his career, because a domestic violence order, it sounds real bad. Think about that. It sounds bad, and it is bad. A governor can't have that kind of a thing on his record.
Alone, with no job, and his reputation in tatters, Stephen hits both the bottle and new lows, trawling the internet for sex.
He had a profile on a website, essentially a website meant to hook up men with means with young women. He'd use that website to meet at least two prostitutes, and this is something that was known to his friends, that he was engaging in prostitution.
According to journalist Josh Kegley, Stephen's behavior grew more and more erratic.
The nude photos of Amanda Ross, he would try to show off these photos to his friends, which made them understandably very uncomfortable. 6 months after this domestic violence incident, he still possessed these pictures and that he was trying to show them to people.
In Stephen's booze-soaked mind, he blames the woman in the photos for his downfall. Resentment burns.
He lost his job. He was embarrassed. And instead of looking inward and how to improve himself, it all turned towards anger towards Miss Ross. She became the person responsible for his fall from grace.
He was very angry at Amanda Ross. So angry, and he told friends that he was going to seek revenge for what she did to him.
Just 2 days before she died, a terrified Amanda confided in her friends. She didn't believe the domestic violence order would protect her from Stephen's rage.
She was very scared of Steve Nunn. She fully thought that he was going to kill her. She told her friends that he was going to kill her, but they believed that she was being dramatic.
She was convinced that Steve Nunn would kill her. And he did. She was right.
It didn't take us long to find out that Miss Ross had a domestic violence order against Mr. Nunn. At that point, we attempted to locate Mr. Nunn's whereabouts.
But Stephen Nunn has disappeared. And the manhunt is about to take a turn for the macabre.
He put his date of death on the headstone.
In a Kentucky cemetery, a lone figure staggers among the headstones. Still clutching the handgun he used to shoot his ex-fiancée, a desperate Stephen Nunn decides to end it all at the grave of the father he could never live up to.
He had chosen that place to end his own life. We believe that he had intended that was going to be his resting place.
Police get tipped off.
The Lexington police began looking for him. And then everybody started looking for him. Somebody that had known him said, "Well, I know where he'll be. He'll be out at his dad's grave."
As they close in, Steve raises the gun.
He had one round remaining in the revolver that was used to kill Amanda Ross. He fired that round as police approached him.
Stephen Nunn might be a dismal failure in most areas of his life, but he certainly has a flair for the dramatic. So sure as he is to how this tragic melodrama will end, he's ordered the final act to be written in stone, his tombstone.
Mr. Nunn had contacted a monument company and requested that his tombstone be made.
The death date was going to be that day, the day that he killed Amanda Ross.
Steve Nunn knew the date of his death.
But he's wasted his money. Unable to kill himself, Nunn hopes the cops will do it for him. But they don't follow the script.
It was an attempt to commit suicide by cop, essentially firing the gun and having the police return fire, which did not happen.
With no rounds left, Stephen finally surrenders.
In my opinion, Mr. Nunn exposed himself for what he truly is, a coward. I think his plan that date was to murder Amanda Ross, then turn the gun on himself. But when it push came to shove, he couldn't do it because he's a coward.
Police find incriminating evidence in Stephen's car. A folder containing the nude photos of Amanda Ross and a rambling 7-page letter blaming her for ruining his life.
Not once did he show any remorse whatsoever. In fact, it was still more about him. He made the comments that when all this was done, he was going to write a book, and it was going to be titled She Killed Me First.
In a cruel twist, Stephen Nunn now faces execution under the same domestic violence laws he introduced.
When Mr. Nunn was a legislator, he was able to push through a bill that made violation of a DVO in the course of a murder a death penalty case.
It is ironic that he got
what do we call that, hoisted on his own petard?
To save his own neck, he offers to plead guilty in exchange for a prison sentence, deciding they can't face a drawn-out trial. Amanda's heartbroken family accepts.
Amanda's mother did not want to listen to her daughter's reputation being dragged through the mud.
In June 2011, Stephen Nunn pleads guilty to murder.
He's sentenced to life in the penitentiary without the possibility of parole. He'll die in prison.
It's sometimes said that from great evil, some good must come. In April 2010, just 7 months after Stephen Nunn's evil act, the state of Kentucky passes a new domestic violence bill. It's known simply as Amanda's Law.
Ms. Ross's family started pushing legislators for what's now known as Amanda's Law, which would mandate electronic monitoring on individuals who have been served with a domestic violence order.
Amanda Ross inspired these positive changes for domestic violence victims, and her family has said publicly that they think she would be honored by that.
Everybody uses this term closure. Well, that's bull. There's no such thing as closure in a homicide case. There's a hole in Amanda's mother's heart that will never be filled. Most times, the last thing they think about before they go to sleep at night is her daughter laying in a cold parking lot. He's in prison for the rest of his life, and he deserves it.
When a woman tries to escape the shackles of a domineering partner, sometimes the only thing to break loose is hell. Desperation drove Susan Polk to murder her husband, exposing his darkest secret, while Stephen Nunn became drunk on power and thirsty for revenge. With great wealth sometimes comes an all-consuming desire for control, and wives who rebel can wind up paying in blood for defying their lord and master. Till next we meet, behind mansion walls, I'm Christopher Mason.